Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is playwright Lee Blessing. Blessing is a prolific playwright, best known for his 1986 work, A Walk in the Woods, about a Soviet and American nuclear arms negotiators, which was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize and the Tony Award. He's the author of 25 other plays. His latest work, The Hourglass Project, will be presented as a stage reading this Friday and Saturday by University of Tulsa Theater. The new play is a comedy set in the near future that looks at what happens when a group of senior citizens undergo an age reversal and become 20-year-olds while keeping their knowledge and wisdom of age intact. While the piece is comic, it does offer serious questions on science and our obsession with youth. Blessing will be a part of the audience discussion talkback after each performance. Blessing's plays have appeared on Broadway and London's West End and major regional theaters around the country like the Guthrie Theater, the La Jolla Playhouse, the Old Globe Theater, as well as the Contemporary American Theater Festival. His work has received the American Theater Critics Circle Award, the L.A. Drama Critics Circle Award, the Humanities Award, among others, and his plays are regularly performed by Tulsa theater companies. TU Theater presents The Hourglass Project in a stage reading this Friday and Saturday evening at 8 o'clock at the Lorton Performing Arts Center on the University of Tulsa campus. Lee Blessing is our guest today. Lee Blessing, welcome back to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be back.
And you're back to do a stage reading of a piece you debuted this past spring. It's called The Hourglass Project, and it's a kind of an interesting premise. It's the idea that youth is wasted on the young, I suppose. And in this play, these older folks are able to go back in time and relive their youth, are they actually going back in time, or are they actually able to regain their youth?
Actually, the premise of the play is that we have moved on a little bit from where we are right now technologically as a society. So you'd have to say this probably happens a bit in the future, but not all that far in the future. And someone has discovered a technology whereby people can not only halt the aging process, they can reverse it. This play was originally commissioned by a college, and they were hopeful I could write a lot of roles for college-age people, characters. And so I said to myself, why don't I write a play about people in their 80s who have literally been returned to their 20s physically and mentally, and see what that might look like. So we actually have actors, you know, college-age actors who are playing people their own age, but with a lifetime of experience as well inside them. And it creates some very interesting effects.
And so it is a comedy, but it does offer some serious questions about this whole idea of going back. I mean, besides the ethical issues surrounding that, and it gets back to this old adage, you know, if I knew what I know now, if I knew it then, you know? And would I really act differently, though, if I knew what I knew now? Because, you know, youth is youth.
Oh, yes, yes. And of course, people are controlled by their hormones at a certain age and in a way that they aren't later on. And certainly the play covers that. It also covers even deeper questions, such as, do I want to live twice? Do I want to go, you know, maybe these people had difficult lives. And, you know, it's hard for them to conceive of a life that is going to be less difficult. And they may be looking at it as a 40-year sentence. that they're being returned to, or a 50-year sentence.
Well, I think the dream would be, I made all these mistakes in my life, and my life went awry. So I'm going to go back and, you know, make those different decisions, and I'll have a good life. Well, that doesn't necessarily always work out.
Yeah, I mean, the play has characters like that. It also has characters who, you know, once they wake up from the induced coma they've been in while they've been returned to youth, you know, they're disappointed. They were hoping that the experiment would kill them. So, you know, you get both reactions.
So it sounds like there's a little bit of darkness with this, but it sounds like it's a little bit of fun, too.
Yeah, it is. It is a comedy. There are a lot of laugh lines. There are a lot of funny moments. There's also some darker and more satirical content in the play as well.
So what was the inspiration for this?
When I got the commission for the play, which was originally with Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas, they wanted me to write a lot of roles for people that age, and I thought, well, I could do that. And what I linked it to in my own personal reading was a book by Ray Kurzweil called The Singularity, a scientific book, basically, in which he's pointing out that sooner than we think, you know, maybe in a decade or two, the advances we've made in artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, and robotics are going to, in a sense, all come together. They're, you know, and when they do, there's going to be a quantum leap in what we're capable of technologically, and it's you know something we have to be aware of. And I thought, why don't I just get us there as a premise for this play, and see what it does to people, you know, and ask the humanistic questions about you know, if assuming we can do this, how does it feel? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? What are the social ramifications? Do people want to publish this knowledge or keep it secret, and for what ends? You know, so the play sort of covers all of that in a sort of serious way, while it examines the experiences of the people in a way that's essentially comic.
Let me ask you: would you like to go back if you could?
I'm of two minds. I think.
I think most people would be.
Play, yeah. After writing this play, I'd have to say, you know, one of the things I've noticed about life is as one ages, life starts to prepare you for passing away. You know, you get to a point where, man, that's enough of this. You know? And you start to think, maybe it wouldn't be so bad to go meet Mike Manker, you know. Maybe that would be all right. You know, and we're conditioned, I suppose, by evolution to think that, you know, I'm 60, 70, 80 years is, that's good, you know, and on we go.
Well, so you had a stage production this past spring. Now you're going back to a stage reading again. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a condition of the residency here at the University of Tulsa, or is there actually a process to your play after that first production? Are you a playwright that generally writes the play, you know, workshop it, you do a full production, then okay, I'm off to the next piece, or are you a person who likes to tinker with things?
I tend to get plays into pretty much producible shape, you know, for their first production to the extent I can, and then see what I can do to market the play, you know. And this play is an unusual situation because it has a cast of 9 20-year-old roles, which makes it highly suitable for college and perhaps high school, but not terribly saleable.
Commercial,
you know, for commercial or Lort and professional theater. They usually hate to go past six actor contracts in a show. And, of course, they usually have a wider range of actors they want to get into their plays. Very few professional theaters say, oh, we have 9 20-year-olds we can go use. You know,
so it doesn't matter how good the play is. It's about the marketing and the contract requirements of the play.
I think in this case, given the unusual cast plot, it's a sort of play that needs to be put in front of college theaters. And so after the Hendrix production, I have sent it off to pretty much everyone I know who's connected to a college program. And Michael Wright here is an old friend and a colleague was interested in the play. And so we're doing this process this year to see where we might go in the future with it here. And then I have a commitment from another old colleague at Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. And I'm hopeful that, you know, this will start to create more productions for the play.
Yeah. Now, how important is that second production?
It's crucial, you know, especially in the professional theater, but even in college theater, you know, it can be relatively easy to get a first production, a world premiere production of a play because theaters can market that. They can get grants for that. You know, it's a much easier path for a theater economically. But they don't feel like they get the same rewards when they're doing a second production of a play. But the second production is crucial because, you know, other theaters need to take the signal that, yeah, well, not only did that theater do it for all those usual reasons, we did it because we like the play so much. And that sends a very, very valuable message.
In that way, it's not much different from the world of classical music or opera, the same or musical for that matter. You know, it's that second production that sort of says, okay, this is something we want to follow up with.
Yeah. Having seen the show, we'd like to produce it ourselves. Yeah.
Now, do you get something out of seeing a second group of actors working your material?
Absolutely. And especially with a play like this where you have a large group of actors, and they're all the same age, you know, so it really is a matter of, you know, can the right person be found for the right role? And I think they've done a wonderful job here. You know, we had our first full day of rehearsal yesterday, so I got to meet the actors and listen to them in the roles. I think they're doing a great job.
Mm-hmm. Is there something you're going to be looking to see how the play works in front of a different set of audiences?
Or? Oh, absolutely. You know, I have a play that's going to world premiere in Minneapolis this year in April called For the Loyal, F-O-R, For the Loyal. Mm-hmm. That's a fictional play, but that's inspired by the Penn State Jerry Sandusky stuff. And I've had that done in public workshops and public readings in five different places in the country, you know, from Philadelphia to Los Angeles, you know, all in different regions with different processes. And all of it, you know, contributed to making the play stronger and tighter. And now, I feel very good about the state of the script as it goes into its first production.
Is that the typical way you like to work? Or did you work this way on the Hourglass Project, or was this more of a, I'm going to write it and let's...
The Hourglass Project stayed right at Hendrix. You know, they had the option, obviously, and they were paying the commission. So right. We simply did it there. And I visited them, visited the students, saw the space, wrote the play, you know, with the space in mind. And all of that, I thought, went extremely well. I know, you know, I wrote a first draft and then I made some very big changes in the second draft, you know, really rearranged it structurally, and it works much, much better now. So there was a growth process, certainly.
Now, it sounds like that other play, the one that will have its world premiere this April,
right,
went through a longer process of revising, or was it a matter of seeing what the reaction of various audiences was? Because it sounds like it's pretty strong material.
You know, the funny thing about that was I wrote it, when I first wrote that play, I wrote it observing all of Aristotle's unities. So it was a play that took place all in the same place, all with the same characters, all in running time. So, you know, there was never a break in time. Everything that could be unified was unified. It was a very interesting experiment. It did not make for the most effective possible play, but it was wonderful to write a play like that. And so I decided, you know, ultimately I wasn't too happy with, you know, its initial workshop. And so I said, you know, I'm going to rethink this. And I broke the play open, you know, after I did the first 25 pages pretty much the old way, up to a crucial moment, a climactic moment. And then everything suddenly, the set disappears. Everything goes into the head of one character. And almost all of the rest of the play is the internal mental process of a single character. It's a little like the occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, you know, Ambrose Bierce's story, where a man's being hanged, and just as the rope tightens, it breaks, and he falls into a creek, and he floats away and has adventures. But at the end, you realize that was all something that happened in his head, and the rope never broke, and he was hanged. Well, something like that occurs in this play, and it suddenly the play was once again ahead of the audience. It was moving, you know, it was pulling the audience along instead of being something the audience felt was predictable, and it was a major change. It was a very interesting experiment.
Yeah, my guest today is Lee Blessing, a playwright, numerous plays. I was just thinking of the plays of his that have appeared in Tulsa, and of course, A Walk in the Woods is probably the best. It's about a Soviet and American arms negotiator has written at the end of the Cold War, pretty close to the end of the Cold War, about, what, 86?
Actually, I wrote the play in 85. It had its first reading in 86, yeah.
Yeah. Fortinbras, which all the ghosts from Hamlet come back. Ely Mossenary, Going to St. Ives are the four that I know have been produced in Tulsa. There's probably more. Mm-hmm. The Hourglass Project will be a stage reading of one of his latest plays this Friday and Saturday at the Lorton Performing Arts Center with the TU Theater, and it'll take place on the TU campus, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You are an amazingly prolific playwright. You're writing about a play a year, it looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the average.
Is that just, has that always been the way it's been for you?
Pretty much, you know. I started writing plays in high school. I wrote a couple of plays in undergrad. Finally, I went to the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. But I went in poetry rather than playwriting. And while I was there, I realized I couldn't fill my schedule out with writing classes. So I was in danger of taking a scholarly course. and I decided, well, I've written plays. Maybe I'll just go across the river and find the theater department and see if I can get into their graduate playwriting. And in 1974, you could do that, you know. There was no difficulty in getting to – I just walked over, handed him a script. He read it. He said, yeah, why not? And, you know, and then I spent 5 years there studying playwriting and getting and ended up with two MFAs, one in poetry, one in playwriting. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I was confirmed in my own mind as a playwright. It just was a genre that I took to more and felt more capable in. In terms of writing. So I and from that time on, I really have averaged about a play a year all through my career.
Now, you mentioned that the Hourglass Project came out of an article you read from Lee Kurzweil. How mm-hmm. much is that an inspiration for whatever you write? Something you read, like the Jerry Sandusky story that's in mm-hmm. the news, how much is that a part of your original ideas for writing plays?
Well, you know, in a way, one's always looking for stories that potentially could interest a wide group of people, you know, a wide audience. And having, you know, when you find one, then I think the challenge to a creative artist is what, in a sense, can you juxtapose that with in your mind? You know, what else are you reading or dealing with or experiencing that if you combined it with this story idea, would you know, create insight, you know, would wake us up in a sense to some thoughts about it that we hadn't had, you know. For example, in For the Loyal, this play that's going, you know, about the Sandusky, well, you know, inspired by but not a rendition of that
right.
those particular events. Actually, it takes place 15 years earlier somewhere else. But the thing I did there was make the central character a woman, you know, the wife of one of the assistant coaches. And, you know, and put all the weight on her of, you know, what should I do? Should I go to the police? Should I not go to the police? Am I going to end my husband's career? You know, and I, you know, simply by doing that, it wakes an audience up. You know, we get sort of numbed by the media coverage of stories like that. We start to think that there's only one way to think about any of it. There's only one set of insights to have. But if you, you know, in this case, find a more interesting character to put the weight on, to make the focus of the play.
Person who's married to the monster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, then you get a whole different set of insights and effects. And so, you know, I think a creative writer in any genre is always trying to yoke two things together, at least two, that at first glance people don't put together. And you know, once you do that, all sorts of reverberations start to get created.
Now, you said that was inspired by Jerry Sandusky. It's not in any sense biographical. It's just sort of a point in which you write your own story.
Sure.
Have you ever done a story that has more biographical elements? I'm thinking of the play Cobb, in which mm-hmm. you have the player, baseball player, Ty Cobb. Again, is that just a sense of, I know his story, now I'm going to tell my own?
Yeah, you know, I've done different degrees of it. In the case of the Sandusky thing, that was simply a point of departure and
right.
inspiration. This whole question of, you know, just as doubt came out of the scandals in the Catholic Church, John Shanley's play, it wasn't, you know, any of those cases. It was something he put, what, 20 years earlier or 30
right.
years earlier. So this is a little bit similar. The a play like Cobb was inspired, I think, because there was not a truthful biography of him published until 24 years after he died, because he worked so hard to control all his biographies.
And he had enough money to do that.
Yeah, and he had enough money to do that, and he was influential. But, you know, and then Charles Alexander came out with a fantastic biography of him, and it was my play sprang out of reading that book and all the rich trove of information, all of which was published at the time. You know, he wasn't using, you know, personal commentary about it. He went back and this was in the paper. This was in the paper. This was in the paper. He did all these things, and it really created an amazing picture of a human being.
Yeah.
But I've had other plays like Patient A, which was about a woman named Kimberly Brigalis who passed away from AIDS-related causes in 1990, and she had accused her health caregiver, her dentist, of infecting her purposely with AIDS. Well, probably purposely. people didn't know he'd already passed away himself from AIDS-related causes. And so she had a very huge political sort of battle in her last year of life. And I ended up, that was a commission. I ended up meeting her family, getting all of her her notes, her the tapes she made when she couldn't write anymore and things like that. And so that was a very personal experience, you know. But I was also fascinated because I didn't agree with her politics. I didn't think that, you know, the policies that she thought we should adopt, you know, should be adopted. And it was, you know, it became a very personal exploration, you know, in that case. So, I mean, I've written biographical material. You know, another one is a play by or from a book by Linda Greenhouse about two Supreme Court justices, Harry Blackman and Warren Burger. It's a play called Courting Harry,
right?
Which is about their relationship. They were both from the Twin Cities.
They're both Minnesota judges, yeah.
Yeah, and they met when they were five and had an 80-year friendship and ended up on the court together, where their friendship pretty much chilled. So it was a fascinating story. And again, that came out of a biography that I was commissioned to
now,
dramatize.
Now, the play that's going to receive its world premiere, that probably actually predates the Hourglass Project, doesn't it, as far as writing the first draft?
Oh, yeah, For the Loyal? Yeah. Yeah. That got started a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago.
It seems like, and I'm just looking at just from years of publication, and maybe that's not always the case, that you sort of go from a dark subject to a lighter subject and back and forth. Is that always been a sense of your work?
I'm a very odd writer, and it's not good for my career, but my plays are very different from each other.
They are. Yeah. You can see some thematic elements that show up. Baseball is obviously something that's close to your heart. You've probably, four or five plays that have baseball in it and some...
Yeah, three or four.
Yeah, three
say.
Or four.
Absolutely.
But that's not the story, but it's a backdrop, and it's a sort of a way of telling a story. Mm-hmm. You have a number of dark plays that are in some way similar to this new play, For the Loyal. And then, you know, so you can see themes, but again, they're very different. Mm-hmm. I think it's a credit to your ability to come up with new stories all the time.
Yeah, comedies, farcical plays, family plays, political plays, and I also change it up a lot formally. I write plays with different theatrical conventions, is often in somewhat different styles from each other. This is very satisfying to me on a creative level, but it's absolutely suicide on a commercial level. You know, the whole point in America is that you create a label for yourself. You know, you become a Neil Simon, you know, or you become August Wilson, or you become Neil LaBute, you know, a writer who we always know exactly what their play is going to be like. You know, they're going to write plays that are very similar to each other. Producers love that because it's much easier to market.
Yeah. Have you given up on the commercial market at this point for the most part?
Oh, you know, I never did this in the first place.
So it was always a surprise when something became commercial?
Yeah, different artists are built differently. And you know, what inspires me is whatever new, strange thing I can explore. And often, because it's novel to me, that makes it more attractive. Most of the playwrights who succeed and do well are the ones who find a groove and work very hard to stay right in the middle of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you talked earlier about some of the limitations of commercial theater. Mm-hmm. When you're making decisions at the very beginning of the play, you're pretty much making decision of whether this is going to be commercial or not. You mentioned this particular piece, Hourglass Project, 9 characters, all in their 20s.
Yep.
It's not going to fly commercially, no matter how good it is, unless it sort of breaks through some glass ceiling of some sort.
Yeah, it already sets up some obstacles, with the very setup of the cast. But again, that's never been a particularly high goal of mine, you know, to do that. And there are writers who simply aren't intrinsically commercial. You know, in their own genre or maybe in related genres. For example, Lanford Wilson never had a career in television or film. No matter how successful a playwright he was, he could not relate to Los Angeles and to that industry. It's not that he wasn't a great dramatist. He was. But he couldn't work that way, you know. Mm-hmm. So different dramatic writers really, you know, end up having different fates based on what they're really comfortable doing.
Now, are you pretty much a creature of the theater, or do you think about film and television? Have you tried your hand at film?
Well, I lived in LA in the 90s, and I did a little bit of TV and film then. I didn't really work in a writer's room, which is the most common experience in LA. But in 2006, I married a fellow playwright, a woman named Melanie Marnich, who the next year got a job in television. So she marched out there and started working on an HBO series called Big Love and did very, very well on it. And she has been in L.A. ever since writing television and worked on, I think at this point, she's worked on four different series and is about to start a new one, including The Affair, which just won two Golden Globes this year. You know, I was teaching in the East, and for 5 years I started commuting out there, you know, to see her. And, you know, we were together about half the time. We weren't too happy with that. And so I, 2 years ago, moved to L.A. again. This is my second stint in L.A. And now I'm out there, and all my friends write TV. She writes TV.
You're writing plays.
And I'm writing plays, you know. So you never know. I might still end up doing a little television, but clearly theater is my natural home.
Mm-hmm. So for this production of the Hourglass Project, the stage reading, are you going to be watching how the actors do the play, how the audience reacts, or what exactly? What are you hoping to get out of it? I know you're going to be doing a talk back afterwards.
Well, you know, part of it is simply sitting down with the play again, because often, you know, between processes, you know, between, in this case, doing it at Hendrix last March and now, I haven't looked at the play much. Because I'm writing another play, you know, and I got here yesterday and sat down and listened to the play read through by this new cast, and it kind of, what's great is that sort of clears your palate, and you can really hear it the way an audience would, and you can say to yourself, does this make sense? Am I following this? Does this happen quickly enough? You know, does this go far enough, et cetera? And so, you know, I've been able to ask myself questions like that, and that'll continue all week, you know, and I, you know, make small changes as we go. But what I'm looking for is the narrative thread of this really pulling us through or not. And and that's what I'll look at with when audiences hear it in readings. Playwrights rarely watch their play; they watch their audience, you know. And the audience will let you know, even when it's being quiet, it's letting you know.
All right, the Hourglass Project takes place this Friday and Saturday at the Lorton Performing Arts Center on the TU campus. Lee Blessing, it's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Well, thank you so much; appreciate it.
Playwright Lee Blessing speaking with us here on the Studio Tulsa. He's the author of 26 plays, which have appeared on Broadway, regional theaters around the country, as well as the Tulsa stage. His latest work, The Hourglass Project, will receive a stage reading this Friday and Saturday evening at 8 o'clock at the Lorton Performing Arts Center on the University of Tulsa campus. There'll be an audience discussion with the playwright after each performance. Call 918-631-2566 for ticket information. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.